This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Stuart Orgel, co-founder of Qualtrics. While you may not have heard of Qualtrics, this Provo-based firm is quickly becoming one of the most exciting companies in the nation. Their online survey tools are used by more than 50% of the Fortune 100, as well as 95 of the top 100 business schools in the world. Their successes put them on the acquisition radar screen of some of the country's most recognized venture capital firms. In fact, Qualtrics founders recently turned down a $500 million offer to buy their company. Stuart, welcome to The Bottom Line.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So that's quite a list of accomplishments in 10 years. But tell us about the early years. Tell us about how Qualtrics started and what you guys do.
Yeah, everyone sees our company and they think that we're an overnight success, but we like to remind everyone that we're a 10-year overnight success.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of history there. When we started, we actually started in Ryan's dad's basement, and it was just the two of us that we were actually in school still, and we started selling this product that his dad had. In his basement. I think the first year I made $8,000. The second year I made $9,000.
Wow. And tell us what Ryan's dad, Scott Smith, what his product was. What does Qualtrics do?
So Scott Smith was a market research professor, and he had developed these products so that he could go out and do research online. And he was really on the cutting edge. In 2002, people weren't doing a lot of surveys online. Businesses weren't collecting email addresses necessarily, so we were really on the front end of it. And Ryan actually started with his dad. His dad had cancer, and he came back to work with his dad. He'd been doing it for about a year or two before. We were really good friends, and I came down. I was always kind of entrepreneurially minded and was always planning on doing maybe accounting or consulting first, and then maybe business school, and then starting something on my own. But I always wanted to have a project going on the side so that I could stay sharp.
And is that what Qualtrics was for you? Was it a side job initially, or were you full in?
It was a side job. So I was talking to Ryan one day about kind of my next idea, and he said, "Well, you should come and work for me." And I said, "Well, I'm not going to work for you, but I'll come and help you out for free." And so I started working in the basement for free. But then after a while, and I think the important part is both of us had multiple irons in the fire. We were doing internships throughout this time. I did two back-to-back at PricewaterhouseCoopers. He had done some internships at companies like HP and Ford. And at some point, I thought I could look for the rest of my life and not find an opportunity that's this good. And at that point, I was all in. And so a lot of times people are trying to be an entrepreneur, but I almost think it's more important to be an opportunist and look for the opportunities, because that's a lot of times what really makes people succeed.
I think that's great advice. And what I like about your path is you minimized your risk, right? Your downside was really pretty trivial at that point. You were still doing internships with Pricewaterhouse. You didn't have to mortgage your house, right? If it didn't work, it's not like, gee, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? You had set yourself up where you were still on a great path. I think that's good advice for entrepreneurs.
Yeah, we were in a safe haven. When you're in school, you can always go back to the career fair at any time, and we knew that. But at a certain point, we committed. And even after committing, it wasn't an overnight success. Mm-hmm. Like I said, the first year I made $8,000, the next year I made $12,000. But I think those were some of the years that really helped us.
What were you seeing at the point where you said, okay, I'm going to close some other doors, and I'm going to fully commit to making Qualtrics a success?
I think part of it is it just felt right, and that's kind of similar, I think, in a lot of situations like that. But then in addition, people that I respected, people from, consulting firms like Bain and friends that I had from other places, when I would talk to them about my plans and what I was doing, they'd always gravitate towards that business that I was involved in. And a lot of people liked it, and it seemed like there was great potential. It seemed like it had legs.
Well, and it seems like from some of the background research I've done, you know, some of the characteristics of your business that your Bain friends probably recognized and said, this is a nice business, is it's recurring revenue streams. You sign up a customer 1 year, as long as the product's doing a good job, next year they're likely to stay as a customer. And probably you come up with some new services, some new tools, you can upgrade them along the way. So you're not always starting January 1st with zero sales and how are you going to book the sales for this year. You're building off of last year, which is a really nice business dynamic.
Yeah, and back then that was brand new. Like this whole SaaS business model, it's well mapped out now. And in fact, we talk to a lot of people that those are the types of businesses that you want to be a part of. The ones that have licenses, that are renewable, you know, that are working with this client base that loves them. But back then it was so brand new. It really wasn't out there.
Yeah. Often the best opportunities are things that are kind of building a new, coming from a new mold, kind of breaking with the old tradition. Talk to us a little bit more about the early years and really advice for other entrepreneurs or wannabe entrepreneurs, specifically salary. You know, you had mentioned that your first year you made $8,000. The next year, I forget what the number was, $20,000. Oftentimes people look at their starting salary and they're making decisions maybe with a shorter time horizon than they should. What advice do you have for folks regarding salary versus experiences versus entrepreneurship?
I think the difference between an entrepreneur and maybe someone else that isn't is the entrepreneur looks at the business as if they're an owner. And so they're figuring out how to make it work. And then they know that if the business does work out, it will take care of itself in the long run. And that's kind of a side point. So I think the brilliance in the early days was Scott was allowing these two kids with a lot of energy, Ryan and me, to go out and make this business happen. And whether it was hiring and putting flyers all over the university and getting people to come in, or whether it was we didn't spend a lot of money. It wasn't glamorous. We weren't competing because, you know, someone had given us a lot of money. Anything that we did, we were having to make happen on our own. And Scott wouldn't allow us to go out and raise money and spend additional money. So it forced us to be creative. And I think that creative element is really important.
And brings up my next question, which is, it's one thing for you to join your buddy and work in the basement. It's another thing to hire good people and get them to work in the basement of somebody else's house. How were you able to attract people that this was going to be their full-time job? Or did people also have multiple irons in the fire?
We started hiring part-time students that could also take that risk. Those were our first hires. And we were looking for someone else who was just as scrappy as we were. So when we'd go up to a campus, we would flyer the whole place, but we would flyer not the standard job boards. We'd also put flyers up there too, but we'd put flyers on stairs, and then we'd only put a phone number on it because we thought anyone that was willing to call us back on that phone number was probably as scrappy as we were. Then they had to show up to this house, walk all the way around to the basement, knock on the door, and come inside.
Right.
And so a lot of people, they never made that journey. You know, some people did, but
Are any of those first five original salespeople that you guys hired, are any of them still with you?
Yeah, definitely. We have several of them that are still with us and have been a big piece of the Qualtrics success.
That's interesting. This is The Bottom Line. I'm speaking with Qualtrics co-founder, Stuart Orgel. So I want to move forward, and it kind of builds on your comments about the college campus. You guys decided your first vertical is what I would call it, your first customer set that you were going to focus on, right? You have to have focus when you're, especially in a small company, you have very limited resources, you have a limited time. And you guys felt that your most likely customers were going to be business schools, in particular college PhDs. How did you decide on that? And were there any tweaks along the way that you had to do in order to bring those clients on board?
I think it was because we had a case study there, Scott Smith, who was already using it for his own academic research. And we knew that if we closed that market, eventually it would be more valuable than two really big clients. And that was something we could hire kids out of school to do. They already were talking to their professors. They could call a professor up and say, hey, Professor so-and-so, this is whoever, and then set up an appointment with him and tell him, you know, or her about the product. And so that was – it was just an easy fit, and it was probably because we didn't have any money to compete with the trade shows. When we went to a trade show, if you can visualize this, you're walking down the trade show and you see all of these different booths, tons of money spent. There's lighting and everything. And then you'd come to the Ryan and Stewart Qualtrics trade show, and it had two banners tacked to the back of it. And we stuck out quite a bit. And, you know, we would trade to get to those positions. But we figured it was our most effective, you know, form of doing business to attack the universities.
Well, and part of what I like about the university strategy is the students that are working with the PhDs go out and work for corporate America, the Procter & Gambles of the world. They know about your tool, and hopefully they take it with them to the P&Gs of the world, the Fortune 500, and it opens the door for you there. But as an initial customer base, one of the things I was struck by is academia is known for having very tight budgets. And so you were fighting that initially. They probably wanted to use your tool, but they had limited resources. How did you navigate that?
We knew academics were a long-term bet. We knew that it would take a while for the students to graduate, but we also felt like our bet was a long-term bet. We weren't planning on flipping the company quickly. We knew we could do it. The budgets were tight, and they were really demanding too. When they would call up on the phone, you know, academics don't have any limit to their imagination of what they would like the product to do. And so it can become very difficult to handle academics, but we knew in the long term it would pay out. And we also knew that any venture capital company or investor that was investing in a competitor
would have told you to go a different route.
Yeah, wouldn't have the patience to go that route. And so we were building something that we knew was special and unique to us, and no one else had the patience to build.
So did it play out like you thought it would? Some of the folks that were working with PhDs that went off into corporate America, did many of those folks take your product with them and introduce you to the Fortune 500 companies?
It did, but it didn't even happen until after we'd moved out of the basement.
Which was how many years? You stayed in the basement for a while, right?
Yeah, we stayed in the basement until 2006, I think.
So 3 or 4 years into the journey.
Mm-hmm, about 3 or 4 years into the journey. At that point, we had 20 people in the basement. And I mean, if you can imagine, just like visualize your front door. Visualize the house that you live in and imagine 20 cars pulling up every morning. And it wouldn't take long before the neighbors start to complain. And
so not only were you, Scott, and Ryan patient, but so were his neighbors.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Qualtrics co-founder Stewart Orgel. Partnerships are hard. You know, oftentimes partnerships don't work out. People are complex or good people. But sometimes it's difficult enough for two people to work together. And really, you guys really have four, because my understanding is Jared, Scott's son, Ryan's brother, is also involved in the company. So there's really four of you at the senior management level in the company. And what has that been like from a partnership standpoint? And do you have any advice for folks that are thinking about taking on a business partner?
Yeah, I mean, I always say that when you take on a business partner, you're going to spend more time with that person than the person that you're married to.
It's true.
And you want to think about who are your battle buddies. You know, who are the people that you've really, it might be through an internship, through a job, it might be somewhere else that you can count on that person. You've seen them work together. And that's what Ryan and I were for each other. But then you added Jared and Scott. And we were all four very different. And
which can be good, but it can be challenging as well.
Yeah. And when you could get the four of us on the same page, it was probably the right decision. Jared came in early on. He took a look at our product and actually was very instrumental early on. He said, you guys are going to be out of business in 2 years. and rewrote the product from the ground up.
And his background is Google, so he knows about scaling things, I would think.
Yeah, right? Well, he hadn't been to Google yet.
Okay.
He had been a whiz kid at WordPerfect and Novell.
Okay.
And came in, and then shortly after architecting everything, he went to Google for 6 years. And then we finally convinced him to join us around 2007, 2008, that time period when we were outstripping the old system, and it was great that we were able to get him back on board.
Talk to us about, so you did get out of the basement, 2008, 2009, you were probably able to get a sweetheart deal on office space, which probably helped knowing how you guys like to run on a shoestring. But now you've kind of got you could, if you're not careful, have two different classes of employees, right? The folks that were there in the basement years and the folks that came on later. Obviously, that's probably not a healthy dynamic if it develops. Was that an issue, and how did you overcome that if it was?
No, that wasn't an issue then. When we moved out in 2006 to the other building and then stayed there for a couple of years, and we were operating under the same model. We were still hiring lots of students or fresh grad students that were doing sales, and that was the core of our company. We hadn't changed anything. When we moved into the new building, we didn't get new furniture. Scott was always there making everything cheap.
You kept the old furniture.
Yeah,
that's great.
But that was part of the test, right? Because when people came in to interview with us, I don't think we had a matching chair in the entire office. They were all from the salvage sale. And sometimes people would come in for an interview into this conference room, and they'd sit down, and sometimes they'd sit in this one chair, and after about 5 minutes of doing an interview, it'd sink down about 2 inches. And then another 2 minutes, it would sink down a couple more inches. Pretty soon they were almost on the floor, but we were just making it work. And it really didn't matter because the thing that people were attracted to was the promise of growth. They could feel it when they walked into the office, and it wasn't because of the furniture. So we continued to build a very scrappy organization of people that believed in it too, and that were willing to go out there and kind of bet on themselves. And I think we've continued to do that, and we kept it very, very flat.
And that probably helped you overcome that issue that could have become a problem, which is kind of two classes of employees, the before and the after employees.
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds like a wise way to do it. I don't know if you were thinking about that ahead of time, but clearly in hindsight, it worked and it was successful.
Yeah, we didn't bring in or infuse other employees that were kind of outside, or you could think of it like a management level, until the current employees or the current team in different areas was almost demanding or needing a mentor in a way.
Mm-hmm.
In order to, and that was really important to us because we had, 2 years ago, we had 100, over 100 sales reps. And we didn't want to bring someone in that couldn't come in and really add value and make everyone else more valuable, more productive,
as a sales
and more
manager,
successful. Yeah,
right. You had
absolutely
to be careful who you brought in as a sales manager. I understand today you're over 400 employees.
That's right.
That's a big jump. And how is the culture today compared to what it was 2 years ago?
I think you can still feel when you walk in the front door that it's a rocket ship ride. The culture. And I think it has still some of the core pieces to it. I think when you're smaller, everyone just knows what's going on automatically.
When you're 400 people, that's a lot harder.
It's a lot harder.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that the culture's changed, but in order to maintain that culture, you have to continue to constantly hire better and better and better each hire. And then also really work to give everyone access to all the information throughout the company.
And that's a big principle of Qualtrics is transparency.
Yes.
You guys work really hard on transparency. In fact, I've got a quote from Ryan. I was reading or watching an interview where he says, "We believe in radical transparency." What does he mean by radical transparency?
Day one, someone walks into our company. They can, if they're a salesperson and they want to see who is the top salesperson, they can look up who the top salesperson is. They can go out to lunch with that person. They can look at the next person. They can see which deals they've closed. If someone wants to look on the support side or the professional services side, They can figure out who's doing the most volume, who's doing the best. In addition, they can also figure out what everyone's working on in the company. So if I want to know what a developer in the mobile team worked on last week, I can actually follow that on day one, my first day at Qualtrics.
Which is interesting because oftentimes, specifically in the sales force, there's competition within the sales force. And really what you're doing is you're giving each salesperson access to the whole team in order to help them succeed.
Yes.
As opposed to competing with one another.
Right. And it helps someone that's new to the organization that wants to succeed find the mentors that they want. It helps them make connections because that's the problem. As you get larger in a company, you kind of wall off areas a little. They feel a little bit siloed. But we wanted to have a company where you'd have access to any part that you want to so you could go out and make it happen.
Let's talk about hiring because that's a big issue. You've hired a ton of people. You know, even the best companies are wildly successful if they can bat 750, 800, which means not everybody's going to work out. What have you learned in the last 10 years as you've helped hire out the team at Qualtrics?
You know, I did a lot of the hiring early on, and I think I have a very good read of people in general. But the thing that I've learned later on is that you want to get as many people involved in a hiring decision as possible because everyone has different insights. And if you can go kind of a consensus hiring model, I think it helps everyone. When you're hiring a salesperson, you need as many salespeople as possible involved in that hiring decision.
It's good advice. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Stuart Orgel, co-founder of Qualtrics. So let's go forward to a major inflection point you had in the middle of 2012. So you guys are growing Qualtrics. You finally move out of the basement. You guys are doubling your revenues every year, which is phenomenal. It's easier to do that in the first two or three years than it is, you know, in years 8, 9, and 10, but you guys are continuing to do that. You've attracted the attention of a lot of folks. And you get an offer, an unsolicited offer, really, for $500 million to buy Qualtrics. This for a company that has taken no outside money. That's a nice payday. How did you guys make the decision whether you were going to accept that offer or whether you were going to continue to run Qualtrics?
You know, we obviously thought there was more gas in the tank, and that's really what it came down to. If we would have thought that there wasn't a future in Qualtrics, we definitely would have taken the money and run. But that wasn't the case. And we thought that we had many great years ahead of us. And so we doubled down again in a way, you know?
So I'm going to respectfully push back a little bit, though.
Go for it.
So, obviously the company has a huge future. But yet you guys have had a huge success behind you. You're a young man. You can take some chips off the table and then decide what you want to do next or maybe not do something next. So it's a complicated decision. Did you guys struggle at all with, hey, this is a chance to really take some chips off the table? We're financially independent. And you know what? For our families, we're financially independent. Our kids are and our grandkids are. That's a very powerful thing, and it's hard to say no to that.
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting and kind of highlights Scott's role in it. He was 60-something during that time, 63-ish, somewhere around there. And, you know, it'd probably be smart for him to take the chips off the table.
And you had mentioned earlier he was struggling with cancer as well.
Yeah, and that was prior. He was over that. Okay. And so he was beyond the cancer point. Jared was basically retired when he left Google and came and worked with us. So he really didn't need anything else. But you had Scott saying, whatever you guys want to do. And really kind
of... really you and Ryan and Jared.
And I think at the end of the day, you're not given that many opportunities to grow a business to something that can really be lasting. And it goes back to that whole opportunity. And you don't want to get these, you know, wide eyes and do something that isn't smart. But when you're given that opportunity and you cut it short,
you might live with regret.
Yeah.
You know, I think the state of Utah is fortunate that the Qualtrics team said, we want to take this to the next level. Because I think Utah has a lot of great entrepreneurs, but what we lack and we don't have enough of is solid companies that have made it big. And you're giving Qualtrics a chance to do that. I don't know. You guys never disclosed, and I'm not going to ask you to disclose who the company was. But in all likelihood, Qualtrics probably would have been turned into a call center here, and a lot of the decision makers would have been taken to corporate headquarters. And Utah County and the state of Utah would not have had a chance to groom and mentor this next stage of entrepreneurs that I think is critically important and I think we need to have in our backyard. So time will tell how that decision worked out. I think it's going to be wildly successful for you. What's your vision for the company today? I understand the online survey business is it's a pretty big business. It was a lot larger than I thought. It's $30 billion. So what's your vision for Qualtrics over the next 2 to 3 years? And do you have a vision beyond that as well?
Yeah, we think that the insights revolution is just getting started. Everyone talks about big data. Everyone talks about all this data that a company's gathered together, but we think that the most important data that a company or an organization needs is actually the data they don't have. So we believe we can give people fast data. And if you think about what's going on right now in the market, every single time someone wants to go and do a project, they want to do get insights from the market or their customers or their employees, they usually outsource it to different firms. And what we're seeing our clients do, they're putting everything on the Qualtrics platform. And so whether they end up owning the data and they're able to go back and reference it, cross-reference it, and continually get bite-sized amounts of data and make more frequent decisions in their company and constantly be tweaking things. And so we think that there's a lot of room left for companies to go out and gather these insights and do research. There's lots of examples of that. There's examples here locally of people that have done it. One of the things that really helped us, and it might not be right, for everyone, it might not be the right way to go, but because we didn't have funding early on, it forced us to figure out how to line up payroll on a monthly basis. And the quicker you can get your customers coming in, the quicker they're actually going to help you form that business and decide what the product turns into. Because the longer you sit tinkering with a product, the longer you're delaying what your company might actually become, because it might be different than what you thought once the customers play a role in it.
Yeah, cash flow is king. And if you have to go out and raise debt or equity, it's going to be really expensive. So that's great advice. Our guest is Stuart Orgel. He's the co-founder of Qualtrics. He's been incredibly busy these last 10 years, taking his firm from three folks in a basement to a company that Forbes recently called one of the 25 most promising companies in America. Stu, thank you for taking the time to chat with us this morning, and best of luck taking Qualtrics to the next level.
Thank you.
The Bottom Line is recorded at KCPW Studio on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss, with technical support from Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. I'm Doug Wells. See you next week.